Hello everyone, Devon Poulos here, Aquatics Manager. Welcome to my crib. We have fun here at the crib, programs included. Become a pass member, play all year long. Here at the crib, we do have rules. We take all payments here at the crib, Apple Pay, MasterCard, Visa, cash. You pay right here to enjoy the crib. So enter through the gate, child-proof, most adult-proof. Hey, what's that?
Good morning, everybody. Today is November 3rd, 2025. It's 10 a.m. We're in city chambers. I call the city commission workshop meeting to order. Commissioners present, Commissioner Duval, Mr. Langdon, Mayor Stokes, Vice Mayor Emmerich, and Commissioner Petro. There's a quorum present for the meeting. Also present, City Manager Fletcher, City Attorney Fuino, City Clerk Faust, Board Specialist Linder. We've got Captain King back there and Fire Chief Titus. And let's see, Trish, you want to lead us in that pledge?
To the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do we have any public comments? All right, then we'll move right into presentations. 25-2970. City Manager, your item, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. 25-2970 is the presentation regarding recent Arizona flood deployment by Mike Navarez, our Deputy Emergency Manager, and I will turn it over to him to lead the presentation.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Good morning, Commissioners. Thank you very much for the opportunity today to speak to you. Thank you, City Manager, for arranging this. So recently, I had the opportunity to deploy out to Arizona. They had a flash flooding disaster recently at the beginning of October. They had some monsoon flooding come through, and they had widespread flooding throughout the state, particularly in the Gila County area. So I had the opportunity to deploy out there into their state EOC and serve as the logistics supervisor for the state of Arizona. So it was a fantastic opportunity for me to deploy out there, help the residents of Arizona, as well as learn how the state EOC operates out there and bring some of those lessons back here to Northport. So in that role, I served as the logistics supervisor, and what I was responsible for was procuring resources for all the cities, the counties, the tribes, and the state out there in Arizona. And then I titled it as Disasters in the Desert because I felt like it rang pretty well. So it was a statewide impact. They had monsoon rainfall throughout the entire state, but really in the Gila County areas where they saw the worst of that. It's a small county to the east of Phoenix, about 2 hours away. They've had two municipalities, the city of Globe and town of Miami. Overall, the population of Gila County is it's a rural, fiscally constrained county. They have 54,000 people, and a lot of them are in city of Globe, which is their county seat. So they saw flash flooding throughout the entirety of the county, particularly in those municipalities, and they experienced about 3 inches of rainfall in a short period of time. Now, I came out there from Florida, I heard 3 inches of rainfall, and I said, well, that's a Tuesday, but in the desert, 3 inches of rainfall is catastrophic for them. So they had 4 fatalities, actually, from this particular event. It was rapid onset flash flooding. It was all throughout their county, especially in the cities. It knocked out the main road between Gila County and Phoenix, which is where all of their resources would come in. And then there was a propane distribution facility that was on a hill in Globe. The water swept through that propane facility and knocked over 1,000 propane tanks down into the city, which created a hazmat incident that needed special team to come in. So these are the pictures there. You see in the top right is the flash flooding going through the city. Bottom right, you see those propane tanks stacked up there that needed that incident management team to come in and deal with the hazmat situation. And then you see some of the damage and debris that they had from this. I'd like to start out with talking about helping hands, because honestly, the first resource requests that we get in for these disasters is people, whether that be emergency management, law enforcement, fire rescue, utility. Really, when governments are overwhelmed, it's bringing in that mutual aid support, and that's how I came into Arizona. So I came in through the EMAC, the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which is that state-to-state mutual aid. So I was actually taken in as an agent of the state of Florida for those 2 weeks and deployed over to Arizona. And when you bring in people, really the most important thing is you want to bring in qualified people, but you also want to bring in people that are experienced and trusted. And a lot of that is through relationship building. So in Hurricane Ian, actually, I was working down in Lee County as the logistics chief. I had the opportunity to work with both the director and deputy director of Arizona who came in as mutual aid there. They saw me working as logistics chief in Lee County and said that, you know, when we have our own disaster, we need to bring in Mike because he's experienced and trusted to come in and run our logistics. So developing those relationships ahead of time in emergency management is super important. And then from that too, now I have people from Arizona, from Texas, from California that had said during this disaster, hey, if Northport ever gets hit, we want to come down and help you all. So it was really a great opportunity there as well. So challenges, every disaster has challenges. That's why they call it a disaster. But really learning from those challenges was what I can bring back here and make the city more resilient in the future. The thing that was unique about this is that it was a no-notice event. I think in Florida, we get into the mindset of hurricanes a lot of times, which are, you know, devastating disasters, but they're usually nice enough to give us a couple days notice that we may or may not get hit by a hurricane. It rained overnight on a Friday, and then the National Weather Service was issuing flash flood emergencies, and swift water rescue was going out in the middle of the night on Friday into Saturday and pulling people from their homes. So a lot of times, most disasters don't have notice, and you need to rapidly respond. Any, you know, time frame that slows that down is life-saving. The next big thing, too, is experience and planning gaps. So Arizona doesn't get disasters like Florida does. They have fires every now and again, but with the hurricanes that threaten us, we go through our process of testing our emergency management program. We ramp up our EOC more times than we would like to. Arizona didn't really have that. This is the first time that a lot of these folks were going through a major disaster at the state level and at the local level, so they didn't have the experience, and they had plans in place, but these disasters always stress test those plans and those processes and those procedures. And a disaster, things break, and that's a lot of the going forward learning process. So in particular, in my role in logistics, one of the big failings that I saw was their primary logistics contract that they had was bid in a way that was competitive, but it was bid in a way that FEMA wouldn't reimburse it. So that was a pivot that they had to make on the fly, because when we saw that, if they used that contract years down the line, when FEMA goes to pay them back, FEMA would just say, no, you didn't use a contract that we approve of. So they had to make the move on the fly to go to other contracts and push those contracts out to the cities and the locals to use those as well. So it was going through that process there, and then their lack of familiarity with some of the FEMA processes, just because they don't get the disasters that we do. So that really went double too for the locals, the cities and the counties there. They were small, fiscally constrained counties. They don't have emergency management. They don't have EOCs. So they were hit especially hard. They had to bring in EMs through mutual aid, but until those emergency managers got there, they didn't really have anybody to advocate for those cities. So we heard after the fact that they were feeling like they were underserved. They didn't have that voice to ask for the things that they needed. They didn't have the EOC, so they were trying to use City Hall. They were trying to use conference rooms, and they didn't have enough space. They didn't have redundant power. They didn't have redundant water. All those things were knocked out. They had people working out of their trucks because there just was no space there. They didn't have anywhere to put people, so it was very reminiscent of what we dealt with back in Hurricane Ian, and they saw very much the same thing there. And then the federal posture, too, was another interesting thing to see when I went out to Arizona. So first, I didn't have on my bingo card that I would be running a disaster during a federal government shutdown, but that was, it gave us some challenges. FEMA was there, but they had like a skeleton crew, and then there were other agencies there too that were involved, but they had even less of a footprint, or the people that they needed were on furlough. So not everything is FEMA for disasters. Most of it is, they're the primary agency, but depending upon the type of disaster, or depending upon the location of the jurisdiction, other agencies have different programs also that they use in there, and trying to figure out which program was going to be correct for the type of damage that they had was really confusing. And I know enough about FEMA and enough about these programs to be dangerous, but they didn't have the subject matter experts because they weren't really used to this. So I'm very thankful that here in the city we have a really cracked grants team that's able to kind of know these programs really well, and we have them in our EOCs, so they're able to kind of deconflict and know the process better than we saw in Arizona. So two with this, we had to balance response with recovery. So really, when you think response, that's the on-the-news part. That's the first couple days of those life-saving measures. And that goes on for a little bit. But once you, you know, finish with Swift Water Rescue, once that life safety element's complete, that's really the end of that response phase. And then you move right into recovery. And recovery still very much happens within that EOC. That's where your debris is happening, your infrastructure restoration is happening, the sheltering is happening. So all of those actions, that recovery phase was very much ramping up even when response ended. So we still had the EOC activated for the entire 2 weeks that I was there and moving on past that. So those two things happen kind of in tandem, and there's a lot of coordination that goes into that. But if it wasn't fun enough there, in addition to the first disaster, they decided to have two more disasters. And I say they decided to, as in Mother Nature decided to have two more disasters. So in about a week into the time that I was there, they had Hurricanes Priscilla and Raymond coming right at them afterwards, about a week after the flooding event. And they could handle no more rain after all of that. They were already inundated from that first flooding event. So having a hurricane come their way and bringing all that additional rain would have been absolutely catastrophic. So all of those recovery operations, the debris, the clearing, all of that suddenly became response operations. Because if they had failed, then it would suddenly be, again, life-saving impacts that would have to happen. So things like cleaning out culverts underneath roadways, those became response, because if those culverts weren't cleaned out, then those roadways would have been washed away and you would have disconnection again to those communities. So everything kind of ramped back up into life-saving measures, and they had a sense of urgency again that came with response. I actually ended up leaving before the impacts happened. Thankfully, no hurricanes actually made landfall. They broke up and kind of fizzled out before they made it there, but they still had rainfall impacts and storms that came over Arizona. So they did see the impacts of that, and that's what you're seeing on the screen there is they had a microburst storm come through a suburb of Arizona, which was basically a severe storm that had up to hurricane speed winds. So they had a second event there. And then Gila County did experience flooding again from rainfall that they got. So the water infrastructure, their utilities that they just put back together, all got washed out right again. So it really, they did have a secondary impact again from that. So it required kind of longer scale response. The key takeaways, though, that I can kind of see there and bring back are these six. So it's that importance of local capacities. So having an emergency management program and an EOC allowed those, it showed a gap there in Arizona because they didn't have those things. They couldn't really well advocate for themselves, or they couldn't manage the emergency at the local level without having the EM and the EOC. So we're very thankful here that the city places a priority on emergency management. We do have an emergency management program here, so that's, you know, a very big plus for us here. And I saw that failing that happened in Arizona for those cities that didn't have those. Another big one that I didn't really talk about is damage assessments. So the damage assessments is the process of going through and cataloging all the damages to residential as well as to the public infrastructure. All of those are incredibly important to do and to do as quickly as possible, because that's how you make the ask to FEMA and to the government to show this is the damage, and so please turn on this program, and this program. So the longer that those went, or the more disorganized that they are, the harder it is to make that ask to the government to turn on the various different programs that the residents need. So we have a very organized damage assessment approach here in the city. It's led by Development Services, and we get to practice that, unfortunately, because we do get hit by the storms. But having that put into place and managed well is very important. The next part of that, too, is the 24-hour readiness. I think we sometimes pigeonhole ourselves into hurricanes and those events that happen no notice in the middle of the night, because, of course, it's not 9 to 5 for disasters. Leaves a gap. So any time that it takes to set up an EOC or bring in your responders is critical, especially on those very rapid onset events. This one, I would say less understanding federal and state programs and more the federal posture. So the federal government came in and FEMA was there, but what we were getting was a lot of push towards local and state self-reliance. So FEMA was there doing the damage assessments with us, but they were pushing a lot towards, well, what are the maintenance records on this piece of equipment that was damaged or this facility that was damaged? So they were pushing towards, you know, FEMA only comes in for the absolute catastrophic level of disasters and pushing more towards local self-sufficiency. The city of Globe ended up spending somewhere in the ballpark of $15 to $20 million for a fiscally constrained city that only had a budget of $60 million. They didn't really have a disaster fund, so they had to go towards emergency borrowing to take out money to fund all of those critical emergency response actions that they were taking there. So it's good that we here at the city have a disaster reserve that we use in order to go for any sort of impacts that we have here. But I saw that very much happen in the city of Globe. And FEMA was pushing more towards that self-reliance and towards making sure the due diligence that they're going to return things to pre-disaster state. And if you can't show what the pre-disaster state was there, they're much more likely to deny that or not count that in damage. Response is a sprint, recovery is a marathon. We know that from Hurricane Ian. We're still recovering here from Hurricane Ian. Response is typically a couple days. When that life safety part ends, that's the end of response. And then recovery, that's really where the big lift is. And then relationship building and mutual aid. So not just me going out there, but having those partners that can come in and help us in our own disaster and return the favor, and understanding, you know, who's capable and experienced to bring in help out is very important and impactful. But disaster management isn't just government. So we have to have good relationship with our county partners, our state partners, our federal partners, but also those local nonprofits and private sector partners too, because we use those contracted services. We work with those nonprofit groups that are doing a lot of good work during that recovery process. And having those relationships ahead of time is very impactful and helpful. That way we're not trying to Google a number on the fly to figure out who we need to call in order to help us out with this particular thing. It's something that's really big that we do here in emergency management. Having that EM program really emphasizes that. And the last thing, I don't really have it on here, but I talked a whole lot about challenges, but there's also a lot of good that we see in disaster response. A lot of neighbors helping neighbors. You have city, county, you have staff that come in that might or might not be emergency managers that are working long hours in a stressful situation away from their families, and they're just there doing the good work. And the director of Arizona would say at the end of every single one of his briefings, everything that you need to do should be through the lens of being in the best interest of the disaster survivor. And I think that was really impactful to hear. So with that, any questions?
What came to mind as you took us through this was what impressions, what lessons you think you learned by being there with regard to federal response, the FEMA response? Because clearly, you know, when it hits the fan the next time here, their reactions and their response and their assistance is going to be probably dramatically different than it's been in the past. So what's our takeaways, and where do we have to tweak what we're doing or how we're doing it, or what provisions do we need to make for where they're going to fall short?
Right. So FEMA's approach is definitely that the federal government comes in when it's beyond the capabilities of the local level and the state level. So they go through and when they come in and they're going to help us with the damage assessments to determine what is the impact of this disaster. Because the federal government will step in when it is a disaster that is beyond the capabilities of the local government. And there's really two big parts of FEMA response. There's individual assistance and there's public assistance. The individual assistance is the money and the support that they provide directly to the residents that are impacted. And then the public assistance is the support that they provide to the government for the damages and for the emergency protective measures and debris that we're doing. So what they're coming in to see is this disaster truly beyond the scale and ability of the local government and the state government? So for that, we want to, first and foremost, have everything dialed in to prove to FEMA that this is the actual impacts of this particular disaster. So those damage assessment processes and having that in there, and also to show the actual impacts of, you know, this damage is from this disaster and it's not from a previous unmaintained thing, because that's the first thing they're going to go to try and stop that.
And to that point, you know, what kind of shape are we in, or what do we think we might have to do? Because you had made the comment, you know, FEMA's ability or FEMA's process to come in and look and see, like you say, what's been impacted by this storm? What are the pre-storm or pre-disaster conditions of the infrastructure and the assets? What kind of shape? I would assume we're in good shape, but I'm asking, what kind of shape are we in to be able to respond to that so we don't run into the problem of well, we can't really hear, we don't really have the evidence we need to show that this government building, that government building, this piece of infrastructure was in the condition it was in. What, is there anything more we need to do than we've been doing?
I can highlight, so part of what we do in EM here, and it's a lesson learned from our previous disasters, is we, part of our checklist of hurricane preparedness, again, looking in the hurricane lens that is our most frequent disaster here, we go through the process of actually using drones and looking at the state of all of our government buildings and our infrastructure ahead of time to show what the pre-disaster state is. And it goes a long way to showing FEMA, okay, this is the current state of this building prior to the disaster. Here's what it looks like now. The difference between 3 days in which it was cataloged, you can show clearly that this is an impact from that particular disaster. So we've experienced it, and we've put some lessons learned and processes in place for that very thing.
Appreciate it. That's all I had. Anybody else? Commissioner Langdon.
Thank you, Mayor. We routinely, when there's a disaster, send someone from the city to sit in the county's EOC. Once we have our own, would we invite someone from the county and the state to sit with us? Is that customary or?
Yep, yes, we would. So in particular, if it is a disaster that impacts Northport specifically, unless a countywide, like a hurricane disaster, and we are the main focus of it, the county may completely come down and embed in our EOC, and then the entire disaster response is led from our EOC. So if it's a wildfire, particularly in Northport, the county will just come down and actually be only in our EOC, not in theirs, so that they're here to support us in the local level.
That would have been enormously helpful after Ian.
Yeah.
Because we were really impacted. If you went to the city of Sarasota, it was business as usual.
Yep.
So,
and the state will do the same thing. If we are the primary impact, the state liaison will come down into our EOC if we have space and if we have a place to put them, and they'll be here to coordinate directly for us. We saw it in Fort Lauderdale after the Broward storms.
Right.
Actually, we saw it in Ian too, but we didn't really have a place for the FDEM rep to be full time.
Who determines that, and how do they determine that Northport is more of the focal point of a disaster than the county? Or
it's really going to be damage assessments would probably be your primary indicator. So getting those damage assessments to show there's, you know, this many residences impacted Northport versus this many impacted in the city of Sarasota and Venice. And if you can make the case to the state that we're the primary impact from this particular disaster, that's where the focus of their support is going to be. Same thing for the county as well.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Anybody else? Commissioner DeVal.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm happy you got the opportunity to go somewhere else. You know, still an emergency, geographically different. Some, like your very last slide, you know, warning you to, you know, keep your door closed. That's something that we probably wouldn't have happen here. But I do have experience with that. Also, when you get out in the desert, out in places like that, at nighttime, it does cool down. And those venomous snakes, they like your warm tires, and they will wrap themselves around them. When you're walking back to your vehicle, be careful. But what impressed me about that was, and in the pictures, the propane tanks. In my mind, I'm thinking, that was good for you to see those things, because those things that happen as a result of the disaster, some of those things are localized to there, but we also have things that would be localized to us. So it's a good thing, you know, what to make sure that we look at things such as, you know, when we have some floodwaters and the floodwaters go down, some of our residents, you know, might find a residual alligator in their swimming pool. Those are things that are going to be localized to us. And it's good that you got that experience, you know, to see that there's all the other things, you know, after the flood, you know, the propane tanks, you know, a propane tank just hanging around somewhere, that can be dangerous. you know, so we have to be prepared to, you know, how do we take care of those? We don't want a child walking along and, hey, what's this? You know, so I really appreciate your efforts.
Thank you. And I think, too, it really helps break that hurricane mindset that sometimes we definitely pigeonhole ourselves into. Like, this was that rapid onset flooding. Recently, we also saw in Lake County just the past night, they had 20 inches of rainfall overnight, and they had bridges washed out there, too. So we very much get inundation of rain and flooding here in Florida that are not just tied to hurricanes. And so it's seeing and being conscious that especially flooding can happen very quickly, and it's not just limited to places with elevation changes.
Mayor Langdon.
Thank you, Mayor. The whole conversation about the propane tanks, we don't really have those. And well, we do in terms of our gas grills and things, but we do have septic systems, and drones won't pick this up. So what happens when an area is heavily flooded? And I'm thinking of Ian. What happens to those leach fields? We call them leach fields in New Hampshire. I forget what we call them here. But how do we assess the environmental impact of that? And did we after Ian?
So I can speak to my understanding of it, though I might have to phone a friend, particularly on the utility side for it. I know in my experience with Ian, which was the Lee County experience instead of the Northport one, we leaned very heavily on the Florida Department of Health and the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, because they had, from a state level, an understanding of all of the different locations of those drainage fields, so the septic tanks, and then what spillway and what damages from those and what the environmental impacts of them were. So we leaned very heavily on state partners for those if we didn't have the expertise in the county at the time to deal with that, because it was very much reportable incidences when you had spillover from damaged septic tanks. Particularly, it was the damaged septic tanks that were spilling out. And so all that day-to-day would be normal reportable instances that we would put to the state anyway through the state watch office. So having those partners were in the EOC at the time in Lake County, so we were able to give locations to them, and they were able to go out and do inspections of those to see the impact of those, the damage.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
The commissioner?
I'm all set, thank you.
I just had one other thought as I was listening to you all talk. You know, what, if anything, I mean, we have, I believe, 70 HOA communities in the city of Northport, thereabouts. Maybe my number's a little off. And I believe there are only two or three CERT teams, two of which I believe are based up in Welland Park, one down in Legacy. But has there been any discussion or talk about how we may position ourselves and the city and our partnerships with these communities going forward? I know many of them, you know, jumped right out if they were in the position to and had the reserve monies or the cash availability to hire their debris removal companies and then seek FEMA reimbursements on their own. Some reached out to the city and wanted the city to help. I know we helped, and I know that we focus on, you know, we prioritize based on need, based on those areas of the city that have resources or the ability to pull resources. But are we giving thought to some of this? Because I'm expecting we're not going to get a real strong support from FEMA and or the county. I mean, when we go through this again, because we will, you know, are we working with these organizations to make them aware of how different our response may be after the next major storm than it was after Ian? Because whether this city's in a position to spend another $60, $70, $80 million of its reserves with no borrowing ability, I mean, that's our only alternative. We're going to tap those reserves again heavy. If we get doubled up or tripled up in storms, we're in deep stuff. So the amount of money we allocate to the first storm into the pipeline is going to be a discussion in this city. about how much money we spend and how much we take. And so to the extent that these communities, these neighborhood communities, are more self-sufficient, and additionally, we help them develop or encourage them to develop CERT teams that can help their own community members and educate them on what they can and can't do. We had one community up there that took it on themselves. They really responded well. They got out there, they cut down a ton of trees on their main district roads, and lo and behold, found that they didn't know what in the world they were doing in terms of preparing themselves to deal with a governmental agency like FEMA. And I believe it impacted them significantly when it came to the ability to try to get reimbursed. So can we, or should we, and can we, and have we been thinking about that? Because they're going to be out there and they're going to need help. And I wouldn't want us to at that point turn around and say, well, sorry about your luck, but you know, we're not going to be able to respond as well as we did or as comprehensively. So the more we can help them stand on their own 2 feet and be self-sufficient, the better, in my opinion.
Yeah. Thank you, Mayor. There's a couple elements to that question, and we've been laying the groundwork for some of them. First and foremost, we need to have an agreement with the community, because it's private property, to even enter there and do any of that debris collection. So we've been trying to get those ahead of time. Previously, FEMA would only accept them per disaster. The state is working to change that and do a yearly allowance to allow entry into a community. But unless the disaster is declared and FEMA turns on a particular program called PPDR, which is the private property debris removal, FEMA will not pay a dollar for any debris that's removed from an HOA community because it is on private property. So unless FEMA turns on that particular program, if the city goes through and removes any debris, even if we have access to go in there, it would be at our cost to do so, to remove any of the debris from any of those HOA communities.
Which is why, again, education, when you consider there's that many gated or that many HOA communities, I would venture a guess that less than 5% of their boards have any clue as to what they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing. They are citizens within our city, and while they have their own organizational structure and boards, you know, to the extent we can educate so they're better prepared and encourage them to form these CERT teams, because they are invaluable in some of these communities. I mean, have a city this big with this size population and only have 3 circuits. Now, I know it's not our responsibility as a city to do it, but we could educate, we could teach a little bit, and there's probably some willingness on the part of these communities to look to us for that education. So
we can build that into we do hurricane seminars with a lot of these communities each year on hurricane preparedness, something that we can build in just as an awareness factor so that they can know that.
Because the landscape's changing with FEMA, and to the extent we're going to know, certainly before the average citizen out there, or you all will, even before us. So the more we can help people, the better. Commissioner Langdon.
Yeah, just a quick comment and question, really, for city manager. We do have somewhat regular meetings with our HOA folks here in the city. Is that correct?
That is true.
See, that might be a great vehicle for efficiently doing some education and encouraging the development of CERTs, to the mayor's point.
Sure, absolutely. It's something that we can, I believe we've spoke to the group before, and it's something we can continually do to reinforce it.
Thanks, Michael. Anything else, commissioners? Michael, thanks.
Okay.
That was a real helpful presentation.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, let us see. Any public comment?
There is none.
Moving on to 25-2985. City Manager, your item, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This item 25-2985 is the presentation by Development Services providing an update regarding potential new development projects recently submitted to the Development Review Committee for review. And I will turn it over to Development Services Director Elena Ray for the presentation.
Good morning. This presentation, we're very happy to provide this as part of our efforts to give the commission more information about things that are potentially coming to the city. These presentations, as well as the economic development update that will be coming to you quarterly, are an effort to ensure that you get information in a timely manner. I know sometimes you get, you'll see things on social media. Somebody will be talking about development that they saw. Everything that you will see today is public record, which is why we're showing it to you. We want to make sure you're able to get information from us. And if you do encounter things on social media, you'll have that information. Or out and about and someone asks you about it, you will have that information. Some key points about this presentation and the items that are in here is that these are potential projects that have been recently submitted for review, either through a formal development petition or through a request for a pre-application meeting. So all of these projects have gone through a review with our development review committee for either pre-app or for their formal submittal. So these are public records. They have been on a DRC agenda. The agendas are out there for the public, and all of the information that you will see today is also available for the public. Certain projects are very preliminary. There's no guarantee that they will come or that they will look the same or anything will happen. There are a lot of steps between now and if they ever break ground. So just bear in mind that things that you see may or may not happen. We certainly hope that they do. This is also not an exhaustive list of all projects that staff is currently working on. These are simply some that are more visible, more of an interest to the public. So they're the ones that you may get questions on. The first one we'll start with, and everybody is very aware of this, is Sarasota Memorial Hospital, the Sumter campus. This is phase two. So as a reminder, phase one for this project was simply the infrastructure, the horizontal infrastructure for the development. Phase two is the actual vertical construction. And initially, they had proposed to build a structure that was, I believe, 5 or 6 stories high. They did get their additional funding from their board and have decided that they are not going to phase that construction. They are going to build all 9 stories within this first phase. 3 of those stories will be shell space. So the top 3 floors are going to be, the structure will be built, but the interior will not be fitted out until a future time. They do believe, based on their projections, that it's probably going to occur sooner rather than later, simply because of the continued growth in the area. This first phase also includes, let me go back, that 9 stories is what they will be building. That will be in their first phase. That will be the tallest building in Northport when it's constructed. So that's going to be a significant milestone for the history of this city. This phase also includes their 3-story medical office building, which will house 60,000 square feet of medical professional offices. And this facility will also include a helipad, so they will be able to take those critical patients that are in need of medical services. As a reminder, the groundbreaking is coming up on November 7th. I know you all got invitations to that. They are very excited. We are very excited to participate in that. Exalt Health is another of our healthcare providers that has put down a footprint in Northport and is already expanding. The facility next door to this is currently under construction, and that's a rehabilitation hospital. It's about a 40,000 square foot rehabilitation hospital. So if you see it just right there at 41 between Pino and Mezzo Drive, that's what's currently under construction. This is their second phase, and it's a 40,000 square foot medical office building. So they are putting down a pretty significant presence here in Northport. Next on our healthcare agenda is our new VA clinic. This is the relocation from Charlotte County that I'm sure you've heard about. It is a new, almost a little over 28,000 square foot facility that will service veterans in Charlotte County and Sarasota County. It is a definite improvement for veterans in South County who are currently required to drive a fairly long distance to get their medical services. This is on Price Boulevard and Main Street, just right out here in front of City Hall next to the gallery. So a very exciting development for Northport and for our veterans in this area. Advent Health, they are coming in strong to Southwest Florida. This is the private healthcare company that took over ShorePoint in Charlotte County. They have, we have heard they've made significant improvements to the operations in that facility, and they have closed and purchased and are now the owners of the little over 17-acre parcel on 41 between Salford and Cranberry. And this is the property that is right behind and next to Racetrack, between Racetrack and Cocoa Plum. So it is a significant property with high visibility on 41. They did hold a pre-application meeting on October 3rd. So they have been in, spoke with staff. Staff has reviewed not only their first phase, but potential future phases. And I want to stress this as we move to these next slides. These are very preliminary, potential, and they're very non-committal on future phases. And there is no timeline for this, but it is public record and it's significant, which is why we wanted to provide you with this information. Their first phase is proposed to be a 24-bed, one-story, standalone emergency room. These are becoming, as you know, very popular. There's another one on 41 in Charlotte County, just over the county line. There's one under that's open in Welland Park. And these are an alternative to the hospitals, the full-scale hospitals, to provide those immediate services. Future phases, which are, again, very preliminary, is a full-scale hospital on this site. A 120-bed, five-story hospital that would incorporate the 24-bed emergency room and also include a 60,000-square-foot, four-story medical office building. There is no timeline for this. We have not been given, and they will not give us any indication as to when this might happen. They still have a lot of studies to do before they move to this phase. But they do project out long-term the potential for a full 240-bed hospital that would include all of the previously built facilities as well as a three-story parking garage. So they are, in investing in Southwest Florida, they are looking at the long game and the needs of this area as we continue to grow. I did get a question. I recently was a speaker for the Chamber of Commerce's government committee, and the question was asked, is there a fear that we will become oversaturated with healthcare? My response to that was that the development that we're seeing in healthcare right now is a response to this area being underserved in healthcare for many years. So there's a game of catch up that's being played now regarding healthcare. And they are also looking at the long-term growth projections. And we've done those growth projections. They've done growth projections. We've provided that information out there. This area is going to continue to grow. There is a lot of land and still a lot of interest in Southwest Florida. So if these healthcare facilities, who are very, very good at projecting their long-term needs, if they see the need and are projecting these types of developments over the next however many years, they know that it's likely to occur. So it's not an issue, I don't think, of being oversaturated, but more right now, the intense development that we're seeing really is an area that's been underserved for a very long time. And now everything is lining up. One of the needs that hospitals have and healthcare facilities have in providing new facilities to an area is the ability for their doctors and their executive level staffs to be living in close proximity to the hospitals. This area in South County has not had previously a lot of areas where the doctors and the executive levels wanted to live. We do now. And so I've had talks about this very issue with some of the members of the Sarasota Memorial Hospital Board and their executives. And that is the key component in providing these healthcare services to this area, is having those places where they want to live. Moving on to non-healthcare, because we have a lot of that. Northport Gymnastics, some of you might be familiar with this organization, this company. They do have a facility currently, a 20,000 square foot facility that they lease up just west of Toledo Blade, north of Price. They are looking at expanding and relocating. So this would be a new facility that is right across from Price from the new Imagine School. It's also in pretty close proximity to two other elementary schools, so a lot of access to kids. As part of their relocation and expansion, they are also reworking their business plan to provide daycare, which is a huge need in this area. They are working to provide after-school gymnastics programming. So having the proximity to Imagine School right across the street, as well as other elementary schools, is a huge win for this area and what's being provided to kids for entertainment, daycare provisions, just a really great opportunity. Cocoa Plum expansion. So we get questions, and I'm sure you do too all the time. What's happening with the big yellow building at Sumter and 41? That seems to be one of the most popular questions, I think, on social media. These are the proposed plans for that area. So this development in the black outline is everything from the existing Publix to Sumter. It includes a redevelopment of the existing building. They are looking at keeping that structure, but remodeling it and revamping it, and adding, in addition to that, another 156,000 square feet of retail space. So this would provide for some fairly large retail tenants, as all the way down to smaller tenants, restaurants, all of those types of uses. You'll notice that it does say in the far corner, one of the other frequent questions we get is, what's going to happen with the vacant Wendy's? So Benderson does not own the vacant Wendy's property.
They'd like to.
They would. They've tried. They've not been successful. But that property has sold to another entity and will redevelop into a credit union. So they have submitted plans to redevelop that into a mid-Florida credit union. So we do expect this to move forward. They have purchased and closed on the property. Price Crossing out parcel. People have said, why is that parcel right next to Burger King? Why has that been vacant for so long? Nothing's happened there. We do have a development proposal in on that for a bank and a dental office. The bank would have an ATM drive-through. The plans that you see here, So that is under formal review currently. Heron Creek retail, we've seen movement on the Heron Creek area, and this is just south of White Ibis and O'Reilly Auto Parts Store. It would be two buildings, 8,400 square feet of retail space total, with two quick service restaurants with drive-thrus. We do not have names of those restaurants, so I can't share those with you, but I can pretty certainly say that it will not be Chick-fil-A, because simply looking at the drive-through queues, there is no way that you will get that many cars on that property. So, unfortunately, no Chick-fil-A. But once we have information on that and we are given permission to share that, that will be coming out. And then next, the learning experience. As we mentioned, daycare is something that's greatly needed in this city. And this is a national daycare provider that is proposing a development south of Price, right here next to the neighborhood Walmart. So right on, as you go across Main Street, across Price, this is a highly rated national provider. They are looking at providing a 10,000 square foot daycare facility with a 5,000 square foot outdoor playground, and they expect to serve about 171 children. So that's a pretty significant dent into what we need here in Northport. We need a lot more. But this is certainly a start, and it's showing that we are getting recognized. I will tell you that this is one of the contacts that was made by our economic development team at a trade show. So it is already starting to pay off the efforts that the new efforts that we started last year to get our name out there and target those businesses that we know we need here in the city. So, more information, and I know we've provided this to you before, but we always want to put this out there for everybody. We do have the current development project map at the link that's available in this presentation for anybody in the public and the commission to access. Also, the Development Review Committee packets are published online, so they are there even after the meetings. People can go there and look at all the meetings that we've had this year and pull up all the packets and the agenda materials are in there. And then on December 1st, you're going to have at your commission workshop a quarterly economic development presentation. This presentation was sort of at the 10,000 foot level. That presentation will be more like the 50 to 100,000 square or foot level. So it's going to be more of a what are we doing from a programmatic standpoint, and some high level discussion about potential development. This is really, you know, the applications that we're seeing come in. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Hey, Commissioner, before I recognize Commissioner questions and comments, I just want to say that for some, you know, ever since the ULDC modifications and adoption, and the fact that, you know, a lot of our projects that conform with the comp plan the ULDC get administratively approved, I and others have been asking for this kind of update. And I have to tell you, not only for us, but for the public at large, thank you for hearing us. Thank you for listening. Thank you for doing this. I would get this out all over the city, because with the disclaimer you mentioned, because we know none of this is etched in stone, but this is what people want. By God, I would love them all to be talking about this rather than some of the other subjects they tend to dwell on from time to time, which really aren't in the best interest of the city at large. So thank you so much for hearing us and listening.
Happy
and additionally, I'll say, across the board, when it comes to hearing how much this existing board wants to know more about things and understand the issues that you all bring before us, so when it comes to the agendas we get and the staff reports, I've noticed personally, and I'm hoping I speak for my fellow commissioners, but certainly I speak for myself, the depth at which and the comprehensiveness at which those staff reports are being prepared now are a marked difference from a year or so back. I mean, the pros, the cons, a 65-degree view of the issue, then along with your recommendations, has really helped me anyway in trying to get a better perspective on these things. So thank you so much. And with that, Commissioner Langdon.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. Ditto. I was going to touch on some of the same points, so thank you for saving time for me.
Even stealing your glory.
I'm very excited about potentially so much health care coming to the city, because all I see are jobs, and I get so excited. But that also raises a concern. So I think some of what I'm about to say might fall somewhere in between your report and what we're going to see from our EDC group. But if it really belongs to EDC, then this might be a request. My concern is I don't think we're prepared to deliver the skilled labor force yet. I know there are plans and discussions, but either do you know, or could you put a bug in Mr. Meerman's head? I'd really like an update on what's happening with the expansion of our technical college. One of the things I was particularly pleased with was the state college system giving them the okay to provide RN nursing programs, which was not the case in the past. But I haven't seen any dirt turned yet, so I'm concerned about that. And related to that, are there any efforts to attract other schools to this area? You know, this Kaplan Nursing, I think, is one of the schools in the area. There are a number of others. So I'd be very interested, if we're not doing that, that perhaps now is a great time to start seeding some of those educational institutions to come here. And I know from previous work that having those kinds of educational opportunities as well is a huge lift to general economic development here. It could attract a lot of other development in pharmaceuticals, instrumentation, that kind of thing. So do you have anything you can share today, or are you going to carry that request back to Mr. Meerman?
Both. So I will put that bug in Mr. Meerman's ear so that he can provide some of that information during his presentation next month. I will tell you that I do know we have a lot of healthcare providers who live here in Northport and commute to hospitals elsewhere.
I don't know what Sarasota and the city of Sarasota is going to do, because I've spent a lot of time there, and a lot of them come from here.
They do. We have a lot of people, especially in nursing and the technical fields, who live here, and they commute to Venice, Venice Hospital at Laurel. They commute to downtown Sarasota. They're commuting to Lee County, to Charlotte County. And I can tell you, I know from Sarasota Memorial, they are standing in line to take positions here in Northport because they want to live and work here. So I know that there are a lot of healthcare professionals who are very, very excited about the new healthcare opportunities that we have coming in Northport, because they're going to now be working near their home.
Right.
So I think that from that standpoint, I think not only will we see a lot of people not having to get on 75 every day, but we will attract more healthcare workers who want to live in close proximity to these exciting new developments.
And that's the perfect segue into my final question, which is a housing question. Mm-hmm. And I know we've had a lot on our plate, and we haven't done an update to our housing assessments in quite a while. You and I have talked about that in the past. but we're seeing a lot of more multi, and I know some of the folks I speak with express some concern. Are we overbuilding there and all of that? So I'm wondering if today you can give us just a little bit of information on, is the multifamily housing, that development that we're seeing, aligned with the pay scales? Not everyone who's staffing those hospitals will have an MD next to their name. There'll be technicians and nurses and LPNs, and is the multi higher density housing development that we're seeing in line with what those job pay scales will be?
So there's a couple of different categories with our multifamily. We have the market rate multifamily.
Right.
And then we have the affordable housing. And when we say affordable housing, it's not what people consider, for instance, Section 8 housing. It's housing that's based on income, but it could be up to 120% of the area median income. So these are households that could still be making a significant amount of money, but they're still at that 120% of our AMI. We have a few of those developments that are coming in. We also have some market rate that are coming in, and they serve different needs in different segments of the population. The market rate, I think we've seen a little bit of a softening from the lending standpoint in multifamily over the last year. So that has slowed down somewhat, but we're still seeing a move forward. Affordable housing is very dependent on the government loans, the Florida state and LIHTC funding, those types of things. So those are dependent upon those grant cycles. The affordable housing market, we do have a couple of developments that are one under construction right now, and a couple of others that are looking at moving forward through the development process. As far as their alignment with our needs, we have people who are at that higher salary level, those MDs. Sometimes they will move into an area and not want to buy something immediately. They want to get a feel for the area, so they will rent for a while. We have people who come down part-time during the year. They'll be here 5 months out of the year, but they want to know that their spot is secured, and they will rent for the entire year, even though they're only here for a specific time of the year. But then those technical positions, you know, all of the people who work the sonogram machines, the MRIs, and, you know, clean the hospital rooms, and all of those things that people tend not to think about. A lot of those positions will fall into that 120% AMI or less. So it is important that we have those quote affordable housing. We could those are really workforce housing. That is workforce housing for our people who do those very necessary jobs. So I don't think we're not seeing an oversaturation in the market. If we were, the construction would stop. We would not continue to get development petitions in if we were in an oversaturated market. And the housing assessments that have been done regionally have proved that out. And those assessments that have been done for Sarasota County show that there is still a great need for that here in Northport and South County.
Thank you for that. I'm all set. Thank you, ma'am.
Before I recognize Commissioner Duvall, just to pony off at that point, have yet, do we know whether there's interest on the part of some of these larger healthcare providers who are coming, whether it's SMH or Advent or some of the others, to provide assistance in the way of workforce housing for their people? And the reason I say it's interesting, it's a side story, it's not healthcare related, but Finns and Sharkies, their owners, you know, one of the things Nick Petroda does as you know, he's mayor of the city of Venice, but his involvement in his family's businesses there are in connection with maintaining a set of properties providing housing for their employees. They have over 300 people that work in their organization, and for years they've been doing this, and that was something I learned recently, much to my surprise, and I thought it was great. And I'm wondering, have we had any discussions? Is there any interest? Because that will be a concern, and there's plenty of, you know, let's face it, the prices out there on one bedrooms are pretty hefty. The workforce housing niche is an important niche for us, as Commissioner Langdon says. So do we hear anything from them, or are they, is that not really on their radar at this point?
We really haven't heard anything from them as to those providers building and owning and maintaining those facilities. That's really not their wheelhouse. So they really are more looking at the private developers to build and maintain those.
Thank you. Commissioner Duvall.
Thank you, Mayor. I was happy to hear you say that sometime soon we're going to be looking at the 10,000 square foot area. Also, we recently have talked about looking at our CIP and reprioritizing our CIP projects. And I think that goes along with it. We want to try to make those two meld so that we're providing the projects that are going to help at that 10,000 square foot level, because, you know, that's what we don't have, is that technical. And going along with that, two other factors. STC, okay? STC is such a valuable resource to us, and I hope that between your department and STC that there's a flow of information going back and forth, looking at things. This Sarasota Memorial Hospital, you know, this, not just, you know, and I have friends, you know, that I wrote her name down, you know, she works at the Venice, and, you know, for her to not have to travel back and forth, and I'm sure it is going to be Sarasota Water, you know, they're going to be saying, wait a minute, you can't all leave and go to Northport. But, you know, it's, as you mentioned, you know, like the people that maintain, you know, the equipment for the MRIs, you know, these are instrumentation and control people that are going to be calibrating all these things. They're at a little bit higher pay level. These are the things that are coming with this. This is, you know, this is so exciting for this. And I hope that that 10,000 square foot level meeting that you talked about and our CIP level meeting that we've been talking about, that we can get them close to each other. But thanks for the insight on things.
You're very welcome. I can tell you, as far as our relationship with STC and Sarasota County School Board, we do have a great relationship with them. We're part of a working group for the Sarasota County Schools, where we look at the future needs of our community from an educational standpoint. We have met many times with the leadership for STC and discussed the long-range needs. We were a big part of the discussions and the expansion that's occurring now with STC. I have been involved with STC and the Sarasota County programming throughout Sarasota County for many, many years in efforts to ensure that we have the technical expertise that we need in this area, not just for healthcare, building inspections, technical trades. I have been beating that drum for many years, and So we are very involved in that and have great discussions with them about making sure that our future needs are met.
Thank you, Selena. Commissioner Petro.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a couple questions. I'll be quick. Ecos Arbor Park, is that the land clearing that relates to that development? Are they doing phase two?
The land clearing that is occurring now is phase two of Ecos at Arbor Park, directly behind the Publix on Price. So that phase is for any age level. The phase behind it, the first phase that is already constructed and open, was a 55 plus and up 55 plus community, but this phase will be for families or anybody.
66 units.
66 units, correct.
And is it going to be still for limited income?
Or? It is. It's for limited income. I believe it's for 120% or lower of AMI.
So 55 plus can still apply.
Absolutely. Any age would qualify for this one.
And next question is healthcare facilities. Which ones are non-for-profit besides Advent Health? And this leads to my question is, how are they structured as far as the tax base paying property taxes?
So SMH is the only non-profit, and it does not, it does get exempt from taxes. So that is the only one. All of the rest of them will pay full taxes.
Do they pay impact fees?
Impact fees as well.
So they would not be responsible for paying ad valorem and not ad valorem, or how does it?
SMH is not. SMH does not pay ad valorem because they are not for, they are nonprofit. They are what's considered a government entity.
And what is what about non-ad valorem? Still?
Well, they'll still pay for their trash service and those types of things. Yeah, but they're exempt from ad valorem tax.
So just SMH. That's mm-hmm. it. And how's impact fee? That was my main question that I was leading toward. On what level are they exempt, and if? Or they're not exempt, and if they're exempt, do we have to contribute? Because by the state law, we have to.
Currently, they are not exempt. No healthcare facility, even SMH, is currently not exempt. There will be an item coming to you soon for consideration of exempting government projects, including the city. The city currently pays impact fees to itself, which increases the cost of projects to the taxpayers, but there will be an item coming to you for consideration to look at impact fees for government entities such as SMH and the city. Not the for-profit healthcare, the Advent Health, the Exalt Health, those will pay impact fees. They are not exempt from impact fees. If the commission were to exempt, for instance, SMH from impact fees, or the city itself, the city's projects from impact fees, the city does not have to cover those. We would not be required to come up with the funds to make up that difference.
For the SMH?
Correct.
Okay.
So to add to you, and I'm interjecting because I want to add to what you were saying, if SMH builds an office, a medical office building, like on the Venice campus, I don't know who built that, but right adjacent to the hospital is a multi-story medical office building. Is that?
It is exempt.
Still exempt.
Right, and Venice and Sarasota County do exempt those taxes.
So it's exempt for property tax, but they still pay impact. Everybody pays impact fees so far.
Well, not in Venice or Sarasota County, they don't.
Not for Sarasota. Mm-hmm. I got you. Okay.
And this, I guess that relates to the new project of Imagine School campus. Are they, because it's a mixed type of breed, do they, are they going to pay any impact fees? Not impact fees, the property taxes? Or?
Yes, because it's not, it's a charter school.
It's a hybrid, okay. And impact fees, they correct. Still have to cover
mm-hmm.
that?
Right.
Okay. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks, good, good questions. Anything else, folks? Again, Ms. Lehner, thank you so much for all this. And it really was helpful to us. I hope it's helpful to our citizenry. I'm sure communication is going to somehow find a way to get some of this stuff out there. But boy, you know, this is stuff.
Lots of good news.
Lots of good news, yeah.
They're keeping us busy.
We like good news. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
All right. Any public comment on this?
There's none.
And what about any general public comment?
There's none.
Well, with that, I can't think of any reason to keep us any longer. It's 11:14. Unless there's anything else, I adjourn this workshop. You are.